Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the Pod of Thunder and Rock and Roll coming to you live from the Chicago airport. Doing everything I can to get you guys these shows on time and on track because I know you need them. I know you feed off them. And I got a great rock and roll show for you today. How about these bands? Kiss, Aerosmith, Bon Jovi, Alice Cooper, The Scorpions, Joan Jett. You know what they all have in common? They've all worked with one of the most legendary songwriters in the music business ever, talking about Desmond Child, and they've all had huge hits with Desmond. Desmond is in the Songwriters Hall of Fame. He's won Grammys. He's also written hit songs for Ricky Martin. Yeah, Livin' La Vida Loca, that's his. Cher, Just Like Jesse James. Katy Perry, Waking Up in Vegas. How about Rat, Lovin' You's a Dirty Job. So many amazing songs. Desmond's going to share some of the stories behind his biggest hits, like Bon Jovi's Living on a Prayer and You Give Love a Bad Name. Joan Jett's I Hate Myself for Lovin' You. Aerosmith, Dude Looks Like a Lady. Ragdoll, Angel. Desmond's also talking about how he went from fronting his own band in the 70s to becoming one of the most sought-after writers in all of music, and how it all sort of happened because Paul Stanley from Kiss was a fan of Desmond's band. That's right, he wrote I Was Made for Loving You with Paul, Heaven's on Fire, Who Wants to Be Lonely, Let's Put the X in Sex. You're going to find out what Desmond's only song he wrote with Paul Stanley he didn't like. He wrote about 15 with them. We're going to find out about the new album that Desmond just released. He and his band did their own version of some of the songs that he wrote and were made famous by other bands. He sang them himself and released it as Desmond Child Live. So we're here in Desmond Child's studio in Nashville, and it's beautiful now. But it's funny because you and I met at the Roxy, judging like a battle of the bands.
I know. We were so good.
We were amazing.
We were so good together.
It's funny because when I showed up there, I had no idea who the other judges were. And I was sitting right between you to my left and John Varvatos to my right. And I was wearing John Varvatos' clothes. And I had just been at Paul Stanley's house earlier, obviously one of your greatest songwriting partners. So it was just one of those fateful moments.
All interconnected.
Exactly. Which is great, though, because we talked about doing this and having a chance to chat. Because, I mean, it's amazing to me. With the exception of a Lennon and McCartney and maybe a Jagger and Richards, for rock and roll and beyond, maybe the best songwriter ever with partners.
That's what I keep saying.
But I mean,
I keep telling him that, you know, but, you know, I'm the guy behind the curtain.
Right.
And so, you know, I just, after many, many years, decades of being a studio rat, I crawled out and decided to make an album of my own.
Of your own songs.
Of my own songs. So I call my show like the ultimate cover band of original songs.
Right, exactly. Exactly. But it's funny though, because I was watching last night some stuff from Desmond Child and Rouge, which was like your original band.
And I'm coming out with the remastered two albums, Desmond Child and Rouge albums. It's our 40th year anniversary. And new music from that group. So it's busy around here.
Right. That was kind of like a Tony Orlando and Dawn type.
No, come on now. I'm ready to fight you. No, we were so much cooler than that. Mm. Well, I don't want to say that because Tony Orlando is a cool cat.
It was more of a contemporary style, honestly. Right.
Well, I mean, they were really a big act on TV and everything. We were like underground punkers in New York, but we were combining dance beats with rock and roll and kind of storytelling, kind of East Village storytelling. So it was more like the kind of predecessor to something like the Scissor Sisters or something like that.
Yeah, because it was very, very rocking, but like it's very New York, a lot of energy. And it's funny because you guys even actually were on Saturday Night Live as the musical guest.
I know. It was a crazy year. We put out two albums the same year, trying to find ourselves. And oh, Jesus. It was a lot for us. You know, we were in our early 20s and we weren't ready to handle all of that kind of stuff. And of course, everybody was talking in our ears individually saying, you don't need the group. You could be a star on your own. And so then, of course, everybody couldn't wait to fly out there and do their solo records. And then 40 years later, we're putting out the...
You got your solo record.
Solo record.
But you mentioned this, though, like Desmond Child Live is a record. And I'm just going to read this for and we'll go through some of these songs later. But it starts with, I've never heard of this one, Living on a Prayer. That's a Desmond. You Give Love a Bad Name. Angel, Dude Looks Like a Lady. I Was Made for Loving You. How Can We Be Lovers? We All Sleep Alone. I mean, Living La Vida Loca. I mean, dude, I mean, can you
leave myself for loving you.
Can you leave some good songs for some other people to write, please? I mean, it's amazing, though, because when you talk about all of these different acts and all these different brands, you were and are the songwriter to go to if you're looking for a hit.
Well, it kind of was like a thing because the bands were competitive then. And so my crossing over from being an artist with Desmond Child and Rouge was writing a song with Paul Stanley of Kiss, who was a fan of ours. And he would come and hang out with us in these little clubs in New York. And he said, hey, why don't we try writing a song? And so we did. And that was I Was Made for Loving You. And that's when, you know, I was experimenting then with a drum machine, and the idea of having dance beats with rock had occurred to me. So I kind of hoodwinked him into this idea of this like four on the floor, you know, dance beat with these heavy guitars. Gene never bought it. He never liked it.
He still doesn't.
Yeah. He doesn't. You know, I remember once they made a record, I think it was The Elder, with and they started doing like hundreds of interviews saying, well, this time we're putting guards in front of the door to keep Desmond Child out. And I was so hurt, you know. It's like I called Paul and I said, Paul, why don't you criticize your enemies, not the friends that put money in your pocket. And he says, well, you know, that's Gene, it's not me. So like the next day I came home and there was a message on my answering machine, and it was like, hi, it's Gene, sorry. And he hang up. And he hangs up. That was his apology.
Yeah. Yes, at least you got one, right?
But we're still, you know, after all these years, he's been an amazing friend and supporter and actually mentor. And, you know, so...
That really was a game changer for Kiss, and also, too, like a whole different style of music. Because if you look at that time frame, a lot of rock acts went into kind of a disco-y type vibe, whether it be Miss You from the Stones or Do You Think I'm Sexy. So I Was Made for Loving You was Kiss's, you know, delving into that. It was a huge hit for them.
Yeah, I think that we kind of paved the way for a lot of that stuff. I mean, the song was singular in its uniqueness. And ever since then, popular music hasn't been the same because people started to say, hey, you can mix genres. You don't have to just do one kind of music. And I think that was a kind of really wonderful egalitarian thing that happened. And the next decade, you know, brought us, you know, Prince and Michael Jackson and Madonna and, you know, George Michael and Boy George and like so many great acts, the Eurythmics, you know, Dave Stewart and Annie Lennox and all of that, using those, you know, dance beats,
right,
and then singing these cool hip things against us.
It's like if you're talking about Michael Jackson, Thriller was based around dance beats with rock guitars. I mean, Beat It's the perfect example of that,
right,
which would be begat from I Was Made for Loving You in a lot of ways if you look at it that way.
Yeah, he owes me.
He does. He does. I'm surprised.
I'm going to go up to heaven and and collect.
I'm surprised you never wrote a tune with Michael Jackson.
I tried to. He asked, after I had this ginormous run with Ricky Martin, Livin' La Vida Loca, She Bangs, Shake Your Bon Bon, The Cup of Life,
right,
all of that, I got a message that Mr. Jackson wanted to meet me. So I flew to New York. I went into this townhouse where he had, I think he was already on the run and Neverland was over. And I go into this long kind of dining room that could seat 50 people and these gorgeous paintings, but it was all very dark. And he comes in his silk striped pajamas, and, you know, baseball cap and big glasses and, you know, and we talked for like an hour. And so basically he wanted to know everything about Ricky Martin. So he was kind of using me to say, well,
where does Ricky go on vacation? What kind of music does he listen to? Who were his influences?
And, you know, like, he loved fame. And he would try to dissect, you know, all the famous people, from Elizabeth Taylor to Brooke Shields to, you know, the Princess Diana, who he was obsessed with. And he would try to, you know, kind of understand how it is that the public, the public's imagination is ignited by these special people. And he became the master of it.
So it just didn't work out, though, as far as trying to write something together?
Well, I went back to my back to Miami, and we said we're going to write the following week. So I flew back again, very expensive, you know, flights, hotels, you know, everything. And of course, I was paying for it for myself. And so I get to the studio at the appointed time at 10 a.m. at Sony Studios in New York. And, you know, there was like a big... table, like a layout of food, like catered lunch meats and cheeses and all this kind of stuff that could have fed like an army. And then I walked in, and then all these cubbies above the couch were all these like stuffed animals. And on the couch was a giant like gorilla, fake gorilla. And the you know, the engineers were there waiting. And so now it was 12 and he wasn't there. And I started getting like really hot under the collar. So I decided to call the house. And I call and somebody picks up the phone and goes, "Oh, Mr. Child, it's Mr. Jackson's very ill. He's very, very ill. He can't come to the studio. We tried reaching you all weekend." Which was not true. And it was him talking to me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Like his voice is so identifiable. Right. There was no one else there. You
know? Mr. Jackson's very, very ill.
You know, with a little vibrato at
the
end.
Sure.
So I just like, okay, well then you can have his people call my people. And that was the end of it.
End of it, right? When you're talking about all these tunes, and you mentioned Ricky Martin, you talked about Paul Stanley, do you sit down with somebody for a while and get a sense for them? Or how do you write with different people, like a Steven Tyler or an Alice Cooper or Ricky Martin, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I think my gift is that I have a lot of empathy, and I can get into a situation and I can put a person at ease with humor. And pretty soon they relax and they start, you know, I start asking a few little pointed questions like, what's going on in your life? And then they say, well, I just got divorced. I said, really? What happened there? And then pretty soon tears and all the secrets and the dirt on the person that they hate. And, you know, everything starts pouring out of them, almost like a therapist.
Right.
But I don't have the code of having to keep anything secret. The patient.
Yeah. Hippocratic oath.
The doctor-patient relationship. And so it ends up in a song. So I never come with anything but maybe a title.
Really?
That comes to my mind. Because I come in cold. But a lot of rival bands that didn't get to work with me started calling me the song doctor, because they imagined that those bands, you know, were writing some crap songs, and then I came in there and turned them into, you know,
fixed them.
Right. But that's never really been the case. I'm a true collaborator, and I have chemistry with certain bands like Aerosmith and of course with Paul Stanley of Kiss and John Bon Jovi and Richie Sambora and Alice Cooper, Joan Jett. I mean, I my gift is that I have empathy and I feel what they're feeling. And so then we get to the core of what they need to be saying today, not recreating their hits of yesterday, because that's absolutely deadly for an act.
It's interesting when you mention song titles, because, you know, I'm in a band too, and the songs I write, I always come up with titles first. And I'll have a whole, you know, my iPhone now, but back in the day it was a little yellow pad of just interesting titles that you'd write down. And you're kind of the king of the double entendre, "I hate myself for loving you," and you give right, love a bad name.
What I call the tension of the opposites. And so that's what any true art has. Even if you paint a black canvas, at some point you're going to put it up on a white wall. Mm-hmm. And there'll be corners, edges to that canvas that then meet the white. That's contrast of opposites. Mm. And so I try to do that not only with the title, but every line of the song, you know, to try to have irony, alliteration. So from line to line, you'll feel the bump of, you know, certain consonants that glue it together, and also try to write as many clean rhymes at the ends of words. I studied with a wonderful songwriter, producer, Bob Crew, who wrote all the songs for the Four Seasons. We spent 2 years writing songs together. And, you know, he was a stickler, you know, for having the title first and all of these things. And once I started working with him, then the hits started pouring out of me because I had that in under my belt.
So what kind of was he teaching you techniques or just ideas? Or
we were supposed to be writing for my solo project. This is after I left my group Desmond Child and Rouge in the early 80s, and I had a singles deal. I mean, I was in such a terrible weak position, and you know, we did, you know, one single and then I got dropped. I mean, people didn't really understand me. And so then I had a hit at that time, another hit with Kiss called Heaven's on Fire.
By the way, to me, the best written Kiss song of the 80s. The best, one of the best choruses of the 80s. I told Paul when they finally started playing it on this tour again, I was like, you got to play Heaven's on Fire. He's like, it's so high. I'm like, just detune it or have singer sing. You got to do that song. It's so classic. So anyways, love Heaven's on Fire. Great song.
So that kind of inspired Bon Jovi, because they had a song on one of their records, maybe the first one, called In and Out of Love. Mm-hmm. In and Out of Love. And that's kind of like a kind of a tip of the hat to Feel My Heat.
Wow.
You know, and so when Bon Jovi was in Europe opening for Kiss, Paul said, why don't you write with Desmond? And so he gave him my phone number, and I walked into this little wooden house in New Jersey at the edge of a vast marsh, brown marsh, where you kill people in The Godfather, where you parked a car and then you shoot them in the head and dump them into the marsh. Yeah. And then at the very end was a oil refinery all lit up. It was like Emerald City. And in this little house, Richie Sambora lived with his parents. So I walk in the very first day, and Richie, who's like the host with the most, like invites me in, and I walk past, you know, on his left is his bedroom, and I look in, there's the Farrah Fawcett, you know, the classic poster, Kiss posters, Led Zeppelin, you see all the influences, and then messy bed, clothes on the floor. It's like my son's now. And then John was on a wall phone, an avocado wall phone in the kitchen. And
shaped like an avocado?
No, the avocado color. Avocado color, you know, like they had back in the day, like leftover from the 60s. And, you know, with the big bouffant hair from Louis the 14th and the ripped jeans and the jewelry and, you know, all of it. And, you know, he was probably talking to his manager, Doc McGee. You know, so he was like, and so Richie showed me downstairs to the basement. It was like Silence of the Lambs down there. There was a little formica table with a little rickety keyboard that was kind of like teetering on it. Some space heaters buzzing, some amps buzzing, a couple guitars on stands, and some dirty transom windows. It was dark and weird down there. And like I like sat there for a while. Mm-hmm. And then finally they both came downstairs. And the very first thing I did was pull out the title I had in my back pocket, literally written on a little piece of paper that said, You Give Love a Bad Name. And the minute I said the title, John's face, I saw my first glimpse of the billion-dollar Bon Jovi smile.
Right.
All those teeth, you know. And then he had a song called Shot Through the Heart. So he's not one to let a good hook go to waste. So he said, Shot Through the Heart, and you're to blame. And then the three of us said, you give love a bad name. And that was our first, you know, three-way high five. And we just kept rolling from there.
Was that song under a different title or different guise released earlier, like in Europe or something, by Bonnie Tyler? Or
yes, I had solely written a song called If You Were a Woman and I Was a Man that started out a cappella. It was produced by Jim Steinman. Mm. So I had written it to order. Jim had called me and he said, you know, I need a song that has a chorus like, should sound like, you know, Bruce Springsteen. And the verse should sound like Tina Turner. Mm. And then the B section's got to be like the Police. So, you know, it was like, I put it together. Like the verses went, how's it feel to be a woman? How's it feel to be a man? Are we really that different? Tell me where we stand. That was a Tina Turner part. And then came the Police part. I look at you, you look away. Why do we say we're night and day? You know, and then comes the chorus that went, if you were a woman and I was a man, what could it, you know, like that. And it's kind of like a knockoff of Because the Night, right?
Right. Totally. You know,
so
Because the Night,
you know, the chords, and you know, it was kind of like, had that feeling. It was like a real Jersey anthem. So because that song had not hit in the US, I was like, you know, I'm not one to let a good hook go to waste either. So I suggested, I started playing on the keyboard this kind of like turn, 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 turn. And Richie was like, man, that sounds like Michael Jackson, like Billie Jean, you know? Is that, or the Eurythmics, man. I said, play it on guitar, but like really kind of distorted and like kind of chung, 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 chung. And he did it. And it was like magic, you know? So everybody brought something to the table, and it created a new style, really. Mm-hmm. It really opened the door, because when they went to make the record, the bass player put in a lot of R&B, you know, kind of Motown rhythm to it. And Living on a Prayer had that as well. You know, and so it had something for everybody and their music.
Sure did.
You know,
very relatable.
But it had an edge that people were calling heavy metal. Mm-hmm. But if you look at it closely, it really wasn't heavy metal. Mm. It was just like, you know, pop music with an edge and some guys that looked heavy metal.
But isn't that the crux of any great song? I always say the best songs, whether it's heavy metal, whether it's R&B, whether it's ska, whether it's rap, I can always, if you can envision five guys in a New York back alley with the barrel and fire and they're doo-wop singers, like whatever it could be, jazz it up any way you want, but a good hook is a good hook no matter who sings it.
Well, that's right. And no, that's not right, because it has to really fit the soul of the artist that sings it.
Interesting, yeah.
You know, and that's one of the reasons I'm very sensitive also to the archetype of the artist I'm working with. Hmm. You know,
like, what do you mean?
Well, you know, there are archetypes that have been with us since the Greek and Roman times or before it, you know, pagan gods and goddesses that represent things that are hardwired in our system to worship, that, you know, helped our survival, the sun god or whatever it is. We had to believe in something. And then in those days, they would have many different faceted, you know, Venus, Mercury, Zeus, Pan, which was the devil, and, you know, all these kinds of strange creatures. So then once we had mass media and started in the early days of the Hollywood, you would see that they put out archetypes, like beautiful blondes that would be like Venus, or they'd put out these witchy girls with messy hair that would be Medusa. And you'd have, you know, the hero, Dudley Do-Right, or that you had Snidely Whiplash. So if you were to put John Bon Jovi in one character, would he be Dudley Do-Right or Snidely Whiplash?
Oh, Dudley Do-Right.
Exactly. And who would Alice Cooper be?
Snidely Whiplash.
Exactly. Because, you know, John was like the all-American boy, the boy next door, the working class hero. You know, right. Alice Cooper was a creature that represented our darkest nature. And, you know, when you talk to Alice Cooper, you know he's the sweetest,
yes.
the most spiritual, kindest
super
person.
Funny, yeah.
But when we went to, when I worked with Alice on an album called Trash, you know, he sat me down and explained the rules. He said, well, you know, I'm not Alice Cooper. And I said, what? I'm Vincent Fournier. Alice Cooper was originally the name of my band, but then everybody started calling me Alice. So Alice Cooper is a character. And so it's like a character in a play. So when we write for Alice, Alice is, you know, is someone who like does the naughty thing, but then always has to get punished in the end. So if he cuts the head off a doll, then his head has to go off on the guillotine. And so we wrote this very fun, it's kind of an operetta called Trash. And all of the bands that I was working with and other fantastic people like Kane Roberts and Jesus, so many people came in to work on this. Joan Jett, Bon Jovi.
Was Ozzy in there on that album?
No, we couldn't get Ozzy.
Okay.
But we had Steven Tyler. And, you know, and they were all writing and singing on the record. So it was a real community effort. It was like a real barn raising here, you know, because, you know, at that time, you know, Alice, who's, you know, he's not an ambitious person. You know, he's like very cool to just play golf and, you know.
Shep won't have that though. Shep's the ambitious person.
You know, and so he loves it, but, you know, only if it's like easy. And so, which gives him a relax and also gives him an objectivity to his work because he's not chasing anything. And I think that Zen quality about him is the reason he's been successful. Now it's six decades and he's a true American icon. I think they should put him up on Mount Rushmore. He should be the next head.
Washington, Lincoln, Cooper.
Exactly. Exactly.
Let's talk a little bit about what you mentioned, Steven Tyler, because you were very instrumental in the kind of the return of Aerosmith, the reinvigoration of their career. Right off of Dude Looks Like a Lady and the Permanent Vacation record. How did that come to be and how was it working with those guys when they were pretty crazy back in those days?
Well, because of the success that I had with Bon Jovi, I had been hired to work with Cher.
Oh, yeah.
And Cher and Aerosmith, they had been signed to Geffen Records by one of the greatest A&R men of history, John Klodner. You know, they had, Aerosmith had made a record called Done With Mirrors, which really, you know, wasn't that successful. And so they kind of forced me, John forced me on the band. They had never written with an outside writer.
Really?
And not even a producer. I mean, they just were very pure and, you know, about their thing. And so I was flown to Boston. A limo takes me to this big giant warehouse where they had set up the stage setup with mountains of Marshall amps. On the floor, though, there was an army of guitars, 100 guitars in rows, like every kind of Sparkle, Telecaster, you know, Gibson, Les Pauls, of special, you know, vintage and kind of boutique ones, rare ones, and they were all in a row, you know, Tiger, Leopard, you know, diamonds, every single kind. So I walk in and Steven comes up to me, long walk, you know, up to the big warehouse doors, and I just like walk in there. And I was a little bit overwhelmed. I didn't know what to expect. And, you know, Steven's a wonderful, you know, people pleaser type person. And he was very warm. And he said, hey, why don't you come here and listen to this? So Joe was off on the side of the stage where the sound guy was. And they were looping a guitar loop, a guitar backwards. And it was going, na-na, na-na, na-na. It's kind of like what they called like a boogie-woogie kind of, na-na, na-na. And then Steven started singing, cruising for the ladies, da-da, da-da, cruising for the ladies. And the very first words out of my mouth, and they stopped and they looked at me, I said, that's really bad. I don't think Van Halen would put that on the B-side of their worst record.
Wow.
And I said, you know, Cruising for the Ladies, like it, Top Down, Sunset Strip, that's the most tired imagery, you know? And Joe now is getting all curled up, arms crossed, looking at me sideways. And Steven, you know, who's still trying to be nice, says, well, you know, when I first started singing that riff, I was singing, Dude Looks Like a Lady. And I went, what? Dude Looks Like a Lady. And then Joe interjected and said, but we don't know what that means. And I said, okay, guys, I'm gay. I know what that means. Bear with me. And little by little, I got them to agree to make the song about this normal dude that just, you know, mm-hmm. you know, working class dude that just walks into a bar and sees this gorgeous, you know, blonde up on the stage, and then goes backstage after the show, and you know, and then she whips out a gun, tries to blow me away. And the wonderful thing about the song is, especially the second verse, which goes, never judge a book by its cover, or who you gonna love by your lover. And that's a song of acceptance. It's not like he ran away.
Right.
You know, because later he says, my funky lady, I like it, like it, like it, like that. So, I mean, you know, sometimes the song's been criticized by GLBT, you know, kind of LGBT. Okay, yeah. I should know that. LGBTQNRDX, whatever it is now, all these different different things start adding to the lineup. Yeah. Sometimes we'd been criticized that, you know, Dude Looks Like a Lady is kind of like an insult to transgender. It's like, no, man, listen to the second verse. Never judge a book by its cover, or who you're gonna love by your lover. If that isn't like open your heart, you know, I don't know what is. Mm. And so that song helped to, you know, put them right back on the map. I mean, that went straight
huge.
To the top.
Yeah.
And, you know, then we went on from there, you know, we wrote Angel and Crazy and What It Takes. And I think I've written like about 20 something songs with them through the years.
It used to be like when, for example, when, cause I'm a big Kiss fan, 80s fan, Kiss in the 80s. Because that's the era I got into Kiss. And I would always look at the album. Like, you know, you'd go to take the bus downtown, buy the Kiss album, and I would look at it. Any Desmond Child song I automatically liked before I even heard it, because I love Paul and Desmond's collaborations. And then when that went on to the Aerosmith and then Alice Cooper, anytime I saw Desmond Child, I'd be like, oh, that's going to be a good song, even before you even listen.
Aww.
You know, and 9 times out of 10, they'd be killer tunes. You know what I mean? So
I've only written one really bad song.
Which one?
With Kiss.
Oh, which one?
It's called You Make Me Rock Hard.
That's on the same album as Let's Put the X in Sex, which is a great song.
That one is a great song.
I love
song.
That song.
But there's also All Night. I actually think that one's a really good song.
Yeah.
But Let's Put the X in Sex was like a joke in a way, because we had co-written it with Diane Warren, who I hoodwinked and dragged her into the session with me and Paul. And before the session, Diane said, well, what are we going to write? Let's come up with a title. So we said, oh, You Make Me Rock Hard. And we just giggled and laughed. I said, I'll never go for that. That's like just so stupid, you know, it's so obvious. And we presented the song.
To Paul?
To Paul, the title.
Yeah.
And I like that. And right away, let's put the X in sex, you know. And like Diane was like, kind of cracking up the whole time. She never written a song like that.
Still one of the greatest titles. Let's Put the X in Sex. It's the epitome of what's great and to other people what's bad about 80s Kiss. I think it's amazing. You're talking about Ricky Martin, because the Vida Loca, when we spoke earlier, I'll ask you this question. When we spoke earlier, 6 months ago, I asked this question, but I'll ask you later on. But La Vida Loca's got to be one of your top three biggest tunes.
It is, and actually we just celebrated our 20th year of the release of Livin' La Vida Loca, which made it all the way to number one, and it was the first song, we made recording history, it's the first song completely recorded digitally in the box, is what they called it at that time. Mixed in the box, everything in the box. And we went all the way to number one, and the Wall Street Journal reported it as a recording history moment.
It's the first time recorded completely on computers, you mean?
On computers with Pro Tools.
Gotcha.
And these Mackie boards that were these little digital boards. We didn't go into a studio or anything like that. The drums were all programmed, everything. And it really, I mean, there was an article that came out today that said, you know, that Livin' La Vida Loca was the thing that changed the course of Latin music forever. Mm-hmm. Because the trajectory from Livin' La Vida Loca to Despacito, written by Erica Ender and Luis Fonsi, and, you know, was number one, you know, just last year for 37 weeks. I mean, it was crazy. Mm-hmm. The sound of music changed because the digital sound gave it like an edge that when you heard it, even on a little speaker, just jumped out. Mm-hmm. And also, prior to that, Latin music producers were using a lot of reverb on everything and a lot of kind of pop elements that weren't really in the nature of Latin music. So one of the things I wanted to do when I went back to work in Miami and live there was to combine all the kind of things I had learned from Kiss, Bon Jovi, and Aerosmith, this, you know, how to write for stadium anthems, and put it into Latin music. Mm-hmm. And I had, you know, then there was this, you know, gorgeous young Latin star that had already been famous, already had an image, and he was signed to Columbia Records, and his name is Ricky Martin. Mm. And I worked with him and his producer, Draco Rosa. Draco and I actually wrote and produced the songs. And Ricky was, you know, very busy touring. So he would come in and we'd get him for a couple of hours and get him to sing. And it was, you know, that's how we did it. And we had the World Cup theme, La Copa de la Vida, which the Cup of Life, which was the what he sang on the Grammys. And from that moment on, it was like a whole new world. And all the other Latin producers and all that, it's like, who the heck is Desmond Child? Mm-hmm. What is that gringo doing here? and in our market. And so, you know, the thing is that they didn't realize that I'm actually Cuban. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in Miami. And I went to high school in Miami Beach High. And, you know, my grandmother salsa danced. I mean, I grew up with all that. My mother was the songwriter Elena Casals, who wrote beautiful Latin boleros. And so they just woke up to the fact that, hey, I'm one of you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so it's been a wonderful journey, because this year I helped to co-found the Latin Songwriters Hall of Fame, and we have a show called La Musa Awards, which happens every late October. And we just celebrated our 7th annual La Musa Awards. The whole Latin industry really takes it seriously. And we had, you know, Pitbull this year and like amazing people. Well,
if you think about it, you know, you basically did with Latin music that what you did with combining rock with dance beats on I Was Made for Loving You. You did the same thing 30 years later, 20 years later, whatever it was with La Vida Loca, because now
I'm just doing the same old thing. Yeah, but I've been doing for 50 years.
But it's trailblazing, because like you mentioned, after Ricky did that, then you get Shakira, and then there's Pitbull, and there's, like you said, Despacito, and it's just one after another. But it started with La Vida Loca, as far as I know, from a layman's standpoint.
You totally.
Know? So that I think that's another kind of indirect pioneering Desmond Child technique as well. You looking something up?
I want to just show you what came out today. Look at this article. Let's see. Came out today.
As the Latin Grammys turned 20, the U.S. is living La Vida Loca. Latin music has never been more central to pop culture. There you go.
Right?
Perfect, yeah. February 99, Ricky Martin made music history, Copa Vida. Yeah, I mean, that's living La Vida Loca, the Latin explosion, which basically was quarterbacked by Desmond Child.
That's right. That's what I told them.
That's you're telling them. But that's what I mean. And so it's funny to me, not funny, but interesting that you have your record Desmond Child live, which is this the first time you've ever sang these songs live in front of a crowd?
These three nights that I did in a little club in New York City called Feinstein's 54 Below, underneath the famous Studio 54.
Oh, okay.
That's where the, you know, kind of the orgy room was originally. A lot of drugs were done down there. And I brought all my friends together and we recorded three nights, and that's what makes this record. But the truth is, I'd never performed live as a solo artist ever. I had my group back then for a couple of years. I'd never been on a stage performing, you know, my own music. Mm-hmm. So it's a very unique record, you know, because it's me doing the songs kind of my way. And it's kind of fun being able to hear it stripped down and from another perspective.
Mm-hmm. And singing the lead vocals too. Which of these songs is the hardest for you to sing?
I think You Want to Make a Memory, which is one of the hits that I had with Bon Jovi. And to sing it, I have to really like reach up there for the notes and all that. But I had some help with some of the other songs. A wonderful young 22-year-old rock singer, Justin Benlolo, who's on, I know he's, you know, the label he's on is associated to Universal. He's making his record now. Tabitha Fair sang, and also Lena Hall, the Tony Award winning Lena Hall, who sang Joan Jett's I Hate Myself for Loving You, which, by the way, has had a new comeback because it's been the theme song for, well, at first it was Monday Night Football and then became Sunday Night Football. And it was originally sung by Faith Hill, Pink, and then they brought in Carrie Underwood, who everyone thought, oh no, she shouldn't sing that. She should sing some country thing. So for a few years, they tried this country theme song and it didn't stick.
Didn't work, right?
Made her go right back. And now she's right there rocking out with Joan Jett playing guitar. And I could not be prouder.
What's it called? Like, so I Can't Wait for Sunday Night?
Or yeah, I can't wait for Sunday night. Yeah. So that's what's called an interpolation.
Right.
But that's a wonderful thing. When there's a melody that's classic like that, you can put any lyrics to it, like in, let's say, a translation, other languages, and it's still the same song.
Let me ask you this. It just stuck in my head. You're talking about the, you know, 80s and 90s and how many records were sold up until a certain point, probably about 2000 and four or five, when record sales started going down, and now it's pretty much non-existent. Do you still receive royalties like you used to now with streaming and all these other ways? You mentioned Monday Night Football using a version of your song.
Well, with the streaming, I mean, the rates are, you know, slowly going to lift. But I'll give you an example. Last year, Living on a Prayer got half a billion streams between Pandora and Spotify. That's as much as a current hit song, right?
Oh, at least, yeah.
You know, 30 years later. And my take-home pay was $6,000.
You're kidding me.
That was it.
Wow.
And so, you know, songwriters have really gotten the short end of the stick when all of this was set up at the beginning. And so that's why we've been fighting and fighting. And last year we had a victory with the Music Modernization Act that was signed 100% bipartisan. Nobody said nay. Both houses of Congress and President Trump signed it into law. But it's going to take 6 years, 7 years for us to see any difference. So it's a great start, but also got everybody aware that, you know, songwriting is a vocation.
It's an art.
It's a career.
Yeah.
Aside from the art, like working songwriters in Nashville, I mean, you know, they used to be able to maybe get a song on a Trisha Yearwood record and feed their family. And now that's not the case unless your song's a single. And so when I first came to Nashville in 1991, when rock died and Nirvana came in, and I said, oh my God. And I heard some music and I said, that sounds like Bon Jovi, but with a twang. It was Garth Brooks. And I said, okay, I'm going to go there and get a song with Garth Brooks. So I came to Nashville and I wrote my first song with Victoria Shaw called Where Your Road Leads, which was the song that Garth Brooks sang with Trisha Yearwood and made them fall in love. So
you got that too.
I made country music history. It was not the biggest hit, but we made country music history with that.
There you go. Okay, so it's rock and roll, it's Latino music, and now yeah. it's this too.
But my point was, when I first got here, there were 5,000 plus writers signed to publishing companies, big and small. And I think last count was like 267.
Wow.
You know,
right.
That have actual deals.
Yeah.
And a lot of the independents all, you know, sold out to the big corporations. Mm-hmm. And so all those catalogs have been combined, but nobody knows those catalogs. So, you know, there could be millions upon millions of songs that nobody's hearing. Mm-hmm. Because only the people that wrote them, who may not even be around anymore, knew about them. And so, you know, that's kind of what happens, you know? And so then music just becomes about what single do you have today?
Right. What about for example, classic rock radio? I mean, there's a Desmond Child song probably played once an hour, probably hundreds of times around the States and around the world.
Oh, well, that's what I was going to say. Terrestrial radio is really, you know, and maybe when people license the songs to be in a movie, mm-hmm. and all that, that's the only place we get a fair shake.
That's the bread and butter now.
And so that's, you know, it's a nickel and dime business. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you get played enough times, there's enough to, you know, mm-hmm. feed your family.
Right.
And so I'm just hoping that, you know, territories like China start paying us royalties instead of just manufacturing copies of our songs and ignoring our copyright laws. Mm-hmm. You know, it's time that all the countries in the world respect each other's intellectual property.
It's kind of like that in South America too, right? It's just kind of all bootleg.
No, it's better. Better in Latin America, yes. Especially every country in Latin America has a PRO. Mm-hmm. And they all, you know, when I'm working at the Latin Songwriters Hall of Fame, they all work with us and they submit the names of their top writers for, you know, induction or to be honored. They're actually paying. But, you know, in certain territories, we're getting nothing. But you can be assured that my songs are heard by almost everyone on earth.
Absolutely.
You know,
one version or
you
another.
Know, they don't even know who wrote it or who sang it. All they know is they know the song. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think I still have a chance, you know, with my record, Desmond Child Live. I'm just, no, that's my song. That's my song.
let's talk about you kind of crossing over into the movie business. Now you mentioned that you're producing a movie on it. It's a very interesting subject that I think a lot of people have forgotten about, talking about Lou Pearlman, the manager, creator of the Backstreet Boys.
20 years ago, a young Swedish songwriter came to visit me because he was on this kind of quest, his lifelong quest, because he was like such a total Kiss fan, was to meet everybody and anybody that had anything to do with Kiss. Mm-hmm. So he was in Florida and he stopped by to see me and we made really great friends. His name is Andreas Carlson. Mm. And he started telling me about O-Town, which is what Lou Pearlman named Orlando, and the boy bands, and the kind of like, it was like Motown. Mm-hmm. So they called it O-Town.
Right.
So it was a real music making factory. And, you know, they had a couple of all girl, you know, pop bands, but mainly it was boy bands, you know, and Lou Pearlman was a, you know, financial genius. But he also, you know, in order to bankroll the whole operation, he started $500 million Ponzi scheme, $500 million Ponzi scheme on the Madoff level.
Right.
That, you know, bankrupted many retirees in the Tampa Bay area. And he was able with those bands to keep paying the dividends. But when the bands left him, everything started to, you know, dry up, and the investors started calling the feds saying, I didn't get my checks. There's something wrong here.
Oh,
so
wow.
Then the noose started getting tighter and tighter and tighter. And he started all these crazy other little bands that didn't make it. And then finally, you know, the noose got so tight, he went on the run, and he ended up in Bali, where somebody saw him and snapped a picture, and the feds, you know, came and extradited him.
So he,
and he
was,
went
he
to
was,
prison.
He was taking investments from people to fund the Backstreet Boys. For
well, actually, it was the other way around. It was, they were so successful, but the thing is that he couldn't back out of the Ponzi scheme he had started. The original money helped to fund the making of the Backstreet Boys. He spent $3 million before they had their first hit on the Backstreet Boys.
I understand.
On traveling, on videos, on clothes, on mall tours,
promotion,
and everything it, before they hit with their first single. He made that investment, but that money came from the Ponzi scheme. But later, the cash, you know, on the table that it took to run the Ponzi scheme was coming from the proceeds of the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC, and they weren't getting their fair share. So they left him and took him to court, and it, the whole thing was crazy.
How'd you get involved in producing a movie about it then?
Well, because back in 1998, when he told me about it, I said, this should be a movie. Now, none of the story didn't even get good till later, but I just thought he was a fascinating character. And actually, he and I were honored by the Grammys with the NARIS Governor's Award in Florida. So, you know, it's so amazing. I looked at the invitation. I saw my name right next to his. And that's when I met him, the one and only time I met him. But I, you know, Andreas and I, optioned the rights to a book called The Hit Charade by Tyler Gray. And there was also a very intense article in the Vanity Fair by Brian Burrow called Mad About the Boys. And we optioned that article as well. And with those rights, we were able to make a partnership with Pressman Film, who had done American Psycho. And I mean, they'd made 85 films. And Greg Basser, who had been the head of Roadshow, Village Roadshow. Now he has a new company called Gentle Giant. He's Australian. And David Anton, who's a marketeer, you know, guru and branding guru. And we've been just working on putting this movie together, and it's all rolling forward, and we're like really excited because we'll get to write a lot of new music, mm-hmm. you know, especially because, you know, all these bands, you know, that are kind of, you know, that he tried desperately to do, we can write all those songs.
Oh, yeah. You know? So have you cast it yet?
No. That the director will do that.
And yeah.
We're chasing like this very big director right now, and like, it's taken months, but it's worth the wait. And they haven't said no. So it's like
well, it's made for movies, especially the fact that everyone knows the Backstreet Boys and Justin Timberlake and NSYNC and all that sort of stuff.
Well, it's not really going to be about them because our movie starts when they actually left him.
Gotcha. But still,
and the Ponzi scheme, it's a crime story with music, but there'll be flashbacks.
Right.
Yeah, so we're not telling the life story of any of those, you know, really interesting characters.
Right.
But you might see flashbacks of, you know, those bands performing.
As we start to wind down here, do you write a lot of music still for a lot of different performers and bands?
Well, I mean, I had a hit with Katy Perry a few years ago called Waking Up in Vegas. And
that's one I had no idea you even did until I looked it up. Yeah.
So that was a number one song. And then with Zed, my buddies, Rock Mafia, Antonina Armato and Tim James have a production company called Rock Mafia. And we wrote a song called Beautiful Now that Zed loved and turned it into this big EDM hit. So that was a number one hit. So basically I've managed a number one hit every, you know, for every five decades, at least one. So I'm good till next year. And actually there's a song coming up that I co-wrote with Eva Max. She's a pop artist. And so I have the next single on that. So I'm really excited about it.
And didn't you say that you had one with Alice Cooper coming out?
Oh, yes. Well, I'm going to be dropping singles on my own that are going to be duets with, you know, a lot of the artists that I work with, but it's of new music. Mm-hmm. So the first one up is Alice Cooper.
That's a great partner to be with, right?
Yeah.
So I guess coming down to it,
my book.
Oh, well, you got my a book too. Well, yeah, I'm sure some of these stories will be in the book.
Yes.
How did you like writing? Tell us about your book.
Well, I decided that I needed an autobiography, so
I'd say so.
I read this amazing book about Aretha Franklin called Respect. That was a biography, it was an unauthorized biography written by David Ritz. And I just tracked him down and I went to see him and he's amazing. He's just like a Zen, you know, his tattoos and like shaved head and like he's like a Zen master. And I went to see him. I mean, he's written, you know, books, Ray Charles, Marvin Gaye, like the biggest stars, including Joe Perry's book.
It's a great book.
And he's been working on one now with Lenny Kravitz. And so I went to see him and within seconds, he started asking me questions and I burst into tears. Mm. It was like, wow. You know, the little pointed questions he started asking me, like, you know, and so he agreed to do it. And we spent 3.5 years writing it. Now, yeah. And we're still tweaking it. And it's going to be released this spring. Mm-hmm. And it's called Living on a Prayer, Big Songs, Big Life with David Ritz. Mm-hmm. And I'm very proud of it. And, you know, it's painful looking back. It really is because I had a very difficult childhood. My mom was a single mom. We lived in the ghettos, really, the projects of Liberty City. And, you know, she was a songwriter and she struggled to get her songs cut. And when I made it, you know, my first money with I Was Made for Loving You, I just said, okay, you're not allowed to bring one thing. I bought her all new clothes, new furniture, new pots and pans, everything. Bought her an apartment on Miami Beach, new car, you know, new everything. And, you know, I had her living like a queen till she passed away. Mm-hmm. So that was a big motivating factor for me to be successful, to be able to take care of my mom.
Let's talk about your biggest song, Living on a Prayer. We haven't really talked about it a lot. I mentioned when we were sitting together at the Battle of the Bands, I said, what's your biggest song? And you said, by far, it's Living on a Prayer. You named your book after it. Tell us a little bit about that tune and kind of who's Tommy, who's Gina? Is that your tune, John's tune?
Well, no, we wrote the song we wrote the song from scratch. Several weeks before, we had already written You Give Love a Bad Name. So I came back and then we borrowed an apartment from a friend of mine, Doug Schneider, that was on 23rd Street and 8th off of 8th Avenue in New York City. And it was this tiny little apartment, but it had this like beat up old, you know, upright grand piano. Half the notes were sticking and all yellowed keys. And, you know, they sat in chairs behind me. And, you know, John wanted to write a story song. So, you know, I started playing these spooky chords on the piano that, you know, inspired a lot by one of my heroes is Laura Nyro, N-Y-R-O, and my son's named after her, which he doesn't like. But, and so, you know, I think the three of us brought our own story to the story of Tommy and Gina. I mean, for me, before, you know, in Desmond Child and Rouge, I had co-founded the group with my girlfriend at the time, Maria Vidal. And she used to work at a little diner called Once Upon a Stove. And they had singing waiters and waitresses. And her stage name there was Gina Velvet. And so, you know, my original name is John Barrett. So, you know, like I was Johnny. And so I suggested Johnny and Gina because it had alliteration. And John said, no, I'm Johnny. I can't sing about, like people think I'm singing about myself. And so then we kind of like picked out of the air. I don't know which one of us said Tommy. It was like a sound alike.
Yeah.
And that's when Tommy and Gina were born.
Mm-hmm. A story song, very much a Springsteen type idea, which of course is one of John's heroes for sure.
Well, really? I mean, I don't see it quite that way, you know, because my influence is so much Laura Nyro. And so it really, to me, sounded more like that. But, you know, I think when, you know, the kind of anthemic choruses, I think it did follow in the kind of Because the Night kind of,
again,
you know, kind of we beat it to death, you know, that kind of lifting feeling. And when we got to the pre-chorus, which was, we got to hold on to what we got, Doesn't make a difference if we make it or not. We got each other, and that's a lot for love. We'll give it a shot. That was the chorus. Mm. And then, I don't know, something in me said, let's write another chorus on top of that. And that's, you know, and I'll never forget Richie when we were singing, oh, we're halfway there. And then Richie shouted out, oh, he was the one that came up with that note that goes up. And then that was the, you know, like the second high five, you know,
triple high five,
triple high five so moment.
Richie came up with the most butchered note in karaoke history.
Exactly. He absolutely did.
But I mean, like you said, every football game, one of the best songs in modern music history, for sure.
I got a text from a friend of mine who's a congressman from Georgia. His name is Doug Collins. And, you know, we may not agree on politics, but he is like one of the most fantastic people, warm and really understands music, and a real hero at the, you know, for songwriters and the, you know, really led the fight, you know, for the Music Modernization Act. And he texted me a billboard. He said 95,000 people were singing Living on a Prayer karaoke at a game.
Oh, right.
Yeah, in Georgia. Right, yeah, and yeah, he was there.
Right.
And it was like, wow, mm-hmm, 95,000. I mean, at once.
Yeah.
And he was like right there. And like, and I saw the lyrics on the screen. I mean, that's a good feeling, you know, going to a Bon Jovi concert. I mean, they do a lot of songs that we co-wrote together. You know, so
there's so many great ones too.
I know.
Like Born to Be My Baby and so many,
you know, Keep the Faith.
Keep the Faith, amazing tune. Yeah.
And, but of course, you know, John will never sing Living on a Prayer till the very last song of the very last encore. So now it's 11:30, quarter to 12, and parents are there. The kids are like asleep on their shoulders, you know, with their little earplugs on. And then no one will leave.
Mm-hmm.
No one will leave without hearing that song. So he keeps that audience in the palm of his hand all the way
to
the end.
They're waiting for it. Yeah.
They're waiting for it. But then when they do play it, you can't hear the band do it. All you hear is people screaming at the top of their lungs, like if their lives depended on it, that anthem. Like they just screaming it. You can't hear the band. It's like most amazing experience. It's like goosebumpy.
Mm-hmm.
And you see people there, older people, you know, in their 70s, 80s, white hair. And then these little toddlers are there. You're looking at like three or four generations, all loving, you know, that same song.
Something that you created.
Yeah, you know, and I just like, I feel very fulfilled, you know, with all of that. And, you know, it's been the song that has kept us going. We call it Living Room on a Prayer.
Last two questions for you. Besides Living on a Prayer, what are your three biggest songs?
Living on a Prayer, Living La Vida Loca, I Hate Myself for Loving You, Dude Looks Like a Lady. Now it's more than three.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's
I was made for loving you.
Oh, that's like in the top one or two. I mean, I Was Made for Loving You gets so much mileage.
Huge.
Remember the movie Why Him? It was all over that. And there's Gene playing it, you know, well, just probably thinking about the paycheck. Yeah.
Even we had this thing, it was Dance Fever, something like where kids dance along with the silhouettes on the video game.
Uh-huh.
And I danced I Was Made for Loving You to my kids probably 50 times. It's a great dance part. You do it all together and everything like that. Is there a song of yours that's your favorite that wasn't a huge hit?
Well, yes, a song that I wrote with Paul Stanley and Holly Knight called Hide Your Heart.
Oh.
And I first recorded it with Bonnie Tyler.
Mm-hmm.
And her whole record had one hit after the other. I mean, I was able to get a song out of Holly Knight that was one of the best songs in the world that I'd ever heard. I didn't co-write it. She co-wrote it with Mike Chapman. And it's called Simply the Best.
Mm.
And the record company said, you don't have any hits on this record. Simply the Best. And 2 years later, Tina Turner cuts it. 2 years later. So then Bonnie couldn't do it in her show anymore.
Because it's a song. Yeah.
It wasn't her song anymore.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It sounded like she was doing a cover.
Right.
But she was the one that brought that song to life.
Mm-hmm.
And Tina's version is exactly like hers.
Right.
So, I mean, I had that song, you know, just like Jesse James. I had so many hit songs, you know, Hide Your Heart. And people, you know, at the record company, they just didn't hear it. Mm-hmm. And, it, you know, there's a problem between, you know, the U.S. company at the time and the English company she was signed to. And they were having internal fights and she got like slipped right through the cracks. Mm-hmm. And she's the most adorable, great, one of the greatest, most prepared singers. We did it up at Bearsville Sound. She never brought a lyric into the sound booth. She knew the song by heart. Mm. I never saw an artist do that.
Right.
And she'd sing it once, twice, maybe three times. It would perfect. And so it was one of the joyous, most joyous experiences making that record. And you'll listen to that record and you hear one hit after the other, after the other, including my version of To Love Somebody by the Bee Gees that she sang. 2 years later, Michael Bolton had a number one with that same arrangement. So, you know, I've had a very amazing life. I've been blessed and continue to be blessed. And, you know, I work really hard. I was blessed with talent and also, you know, all the things that I thought were against me, being Latino, being poor, being gay, all of those things turned out were the pluses mm-hmm. that made me who I am today.
The character, right? Yeah. Well, Desmond, man, what an honor to talk to you. Like I said, Latin music, disco rock, country music, putting together Garth Brooks and Trish Yearwood. I mean, come on, man. Can you cure cancer next, please? Can you write an anti-cancer song that cures cancer?
Thank you. Okay, let's do it now.
No more cancer. Thanks, man. Right, Desmond Child's new record is called Desmond Child Live. It's a great collection of all the hit tunes he's written over the years, performed by Desmond himself and his great band. So get it wherever you stream or download music. And how many hits does this guy have? It's absolutely unbelievable. So 70 top 40 hits. Good for Desmond. Great guy and great show. So coming up on Friday, he's the Spanish god, the Spanish sex god of the inner circle. He's telling his story here first. Sammy Guevara on Talk is Jericho, my protege and my partner in crime. He's got a great story as well. So we will see you on Friday. Until then, stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs, and the big yeah, boy, living on a path.